This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about giftedness. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. When Michael Winkler started elementary school, it was not for him.
I hated school. I always have. I really struggled focusing and being patient. The classroom setting was particularly miserable for me.
He's in his late 30s now and usually just goes by his last name, Winkler. By second grade, school took a turn for the better when he was identified as gifted. He doesn't exactly remember how that happened, IQ testing or teacher recommendations, but one day a week, he and a bunch of other kids would get on a bus and they were taken to a separate building for the whole day. He loved it. It was largely self-directed, and it didn't really feel like school.
There was no grades. There was no, like, hey, this is good or this isn't good. It was just kind of exploratory in that sense.
They would get to play music, create software programs, do science experiments.
Me and one of my classmates were testing the acidity levels of various cola products to see how acidic what you were putting in your body was. And, you know, well, not too complicated science stuff, but, you know, for an 8-year-old, it was pretty interesting to learn about acids and bases and stuff like that.
But all of the regular classes he still had to take, they were a slog.
The teachers would be discussing and teaching things that I had known for years already. I basically would get in trouble if I did anything other than just sit silently and just stare at the teacher while they just repeated stuff that I had heard a million times or already knew.
To fight the boredom, he would talk in class, read books that he had hidden inside of his desk, or distract himself.
I got really good at, like, juggling my pencils. It was almost like a circus daredevil act where I would often have sharpened pencils and nothing to do with them, so I would just sit there and spin them up in the air and see how many times I could rotate them and catch them. I still have graphite, like, tattoos in my palms from the sharp pencils coming down and embedding themselves in my palm. I'm looking at one right now.
By middle school, Winkler's grades started sinking to C's and D's. He wasn't paying attention in class, and he wasn't doing his homework or projects. He was barely scraping by. And so finally, in seventh grade, his parents sent him to a private school where students could do a lot of self-directed learning. Winkler was able to process the material at his own pace. But when he got to college, he absolutely tanked.
My GPA was so low my first semester of freshman year that they just immediately just dismissed me from the school. I think I got a 0.7 my first semester.
Winkler couldn't keep up, and he ended up taking some time off. So what happened to his early promise of intellectual prowess, his giftedness? Turns out this kind of crash and burn among kids who were recognized as gifted is common. There is a whole subreddit dedicated to this issue, an online discussion community called After Gifted. It has over 30,000 users and posts with titles like Intelligence is a Curse or Being Proclaimed as Gifted Ruined My Life. There's also a lot of talk about wasted potential and gifted burnout. Liz Tung looked into the gifted label and what new science suggests it really means.
I never thought of being gifted as meaning anything other than being a smart kid who got good grades. But then I talked with Matt Zakreski. He's a psychologist and former gifted kid himself, who now works with and consults on the topic of gifted kids. And he offered me a very different definition.
One thing we know about giftedness is that it is quite literally a different brain, right? It's a piece of neurodivergence.
Right off the bat, this idea that giftedness is a form of neurodivergence blew me away. Because I've always associated neurodivergence with things like autism or ADHD or dyslexia, differences that are considered disabilities. While I'd always thought of giftedness as kind of the opposite, like having intellectual superpowers, able to scale an algebra test in a single bound. And in fact, that is how giftedness was regarded for a really long time.
You can trace that all the way back to Lewis Terman and it's the termites study, right?
Lewis Terman was a psychologist. and, by the way, a proponent of eugenics, who in 1916 helped pioneer the first widely used IQ test in the U.S., the Stanford-Binet. It was a major leap forward for intelligence research. And in 1921, Lewis Terman used the test to identify and begin studying so-called child geniuses, or as he called them, termites, like the insects, though, of course, named after himself.
Like, you know, it's like he tried to make fetch happen.
The name didn't stick, but interest in cultivating gifted children did. The termite study followed roughly 1,500 high IQ subjects from childhood through to old age, looking at their academic performance, interests, personalities, relationships, family histories, etc. Lewis Terman's goal was to disprove the then widely held belief that gifted kids were by and large weakly, maladjusted weirdos, and instead show that they were successful, born leaders whose intelligence deserved to be recognized and cultivated through special education. The idea gained increasing steam with the launch of Sputnik, which spurred the U.S. government to invest funds in gifted education in an effort to keep up with the Soviets. In the years since, gifted education has never fully gelled on a national level. Programs differ state by state and even district by district. And the same goes for deciding who qualifies as gifted. In some places, kids can be nominated by teachers or school counselors. In others, it's about grades and classroom performance. And still others use specialized giftedness assessments or IQ tests. 130 is usually recognized as the minimum IQ score to qualify. But one thing just about every system shares is the idea that being gifted is all about book smarts. And cultivating giftedness is all about achievement.
If you use me as a case study, right, I was born in 1983, so I'm 40. And growing up, it was very much gifted is smart. Smart means you're going to go to Harvard. You're going to probably get a doctorate, do something fancy, right?
But over the past 15 to 20 years, things have started to change. Thanks in part to fMRI studies of gifted kids that show that their brains are actually physically different. So, for example, take a typical 10-year-old. They're 10 physically, intellectually, emotionally, and socially. But gifted kids' brains develop differently, or asynchronously, as Matt says.
And we know there's just so much developmental energy goes to the, you know, the top part of the brain, the cerebral cortex, that other things sort of lag. Because there's only so much energy to go around, right? So that same 10-year-old, if they're gifted, will be intellectually 15, academically 14, socially 9, emotionally 8.
For example, studies have found that gifted kids have greater volume and connectivity in their cerebral cortex, which allows them to absorb and process information faster. And they maintain this info sponge phase for longer than other kids. The downside is that because their brains take in so much information and process it so quickly, further development of the prefrontal cortex gets slowed down. Essentially, you get a bottleneck because the prefrontal cortex is overwhelmed in addition to being developmentally delayed compared to the rest of the brain, which is one reason why scientists think that a lot of gifted kids struggle with executive functioning, the ability to prioritize, manage time, stay focused and organized, not to mention social skills and emotional regulation. In fact, in a lot of cases, gifted brains can look a lot like other kinds of neurodivergent brains.
And now we're seeing that it's, oh my gosh, there's so much overlap between autistic brains and ADHD brains and gifted brains and dyslexic brains, and you might have all of them.
Many gifted kids are smart enough that they can compensate for and mask those deficits. But eventually, a lot of them end up hitting a wall. One reason, Matt says, is they never learn how to study. They get used to being able to absorb things quickly and sail through their classes.
You never learn things like grit, study skills, asking for help, tolerating failure, because you're never meaningfully challenged.
Until usually in high school or college, things suddenly get a lot more challenging. A phenomenon that Matt says is called the performance cliff, and that gets compounded for kids who also struggle with executive functioning. Take Winkler, the guy we heard from earlier who failed out his first semester of college. In high school, his parents and teachers had kept him in line. But at college, that structure was gone. He had to manage his own time and work, and he didn't know how to do it. For some gifted kids, this experience of falling off the performance cliff is the end of the line. Matt told me multiple stories of gifted kids who ended up dropping out of high school or college and now work minimum wage jobs. Or worse, can't manage to keep minimum wage jobs because they're lacking in, say, people skills. Winkler, however, eventually managed to figure things out. He took a year off, spending his days taking continuing education classes and teaching himself how to study, and his nights working as a forklift operator. After graduating college, he spent his 20s in China. He now works in technology services at a fancy hotel. And he told me he's never felt the kind of angst many ex-gifted kids feel about their quote-unquote wasted potential.
I know that I probably had the processing ability to live a different life, but I've never felt like that was my calling and I missed out on it or anything. I kind of feel that I made the choices that led me on a path that makes a lot of sense.
Lucky for Winkler, he was never that invested in school. But Matt says for kids who care deeply about academics, especially the ones who end up at elite colleges surrounded by equally intelligent classmates who did learn how to study and work hard, academic failure can be a profoundly destabilizing experience.
And in the absence of a better narrative, most gifted people who are used to solving their own problems through just sheer force of will go, I must be broken. I must be deficient, right? There's something wrong with me now.
And for kids whose entire sense of self and self-worth is invested in their intelligence, that can feel disastrous, even if their perceived failures aren't failures at all. Take, for example, a guy I'm going to call Brian in order to preserve his privacy.
I'm 29 years old. And I currently work as a postdoc at the NIH.
AKA the National Institutes of Health, which to me sounds prestigious and impressive. But that's not how Brian feels. In fact, I found him through a Reddit post he wrote entitled, I feel like I fell short of expectations. Am I wasting my potential? As a kid, Brian excelled academically. He tested into the gifted program in second grade, sailed through most of school, and when he needed to put the work in, he did it. He ended up getting a full ride to an elite college, where he majored in pre-med. And while he never exactly hit the performance cliff in college, he did start struggling in other ways.
It just felt like I was, like, losing interest in doing, like, anything. I was going into, like, a very dark spiral mental health wise. And I was constantly in this like mental loop of comparing myself to my peers who were just so much better than me at everything.
He says he was surviving academically, but socially he felt like an outcast. He didn't like to party or play sports. He was into niche, nerdy interests like board games and fantasy books. And over time, he came to see his not fitting in as a kind of failure, a deficiency on his part.
Socially, I couldn't keep up. Other people, not only can they get excellent grades, they can also do all sorts of extracurriculars, be in leadership roles, do research, and then still have the time to party on the weekends and like maintain relationships. And I just felt like it was just too much. I couldn't keep up with it.
Brian's mental health crisis came to a head his senior year, right at the peak of the med school application frenzy.
Thinking that I'm a loser, that there was a whole other aspect of life that I just neglected.
Brian was reluctant to talk about this next part, the peak of his mental health crisis. But finally, he said that he posted something on social media, venting his fears and frustrations.
I think I was actually starting to get worried that, like, I was going to get into like the incel stuff.
Brian never did become an incel, but he felt like he was at the end of his rope. Despite all this, there was a bright spot. He got accepted to medical school, but then it all came crashing down.
And so, like, somebody ended up reporting the incel stuff to the medical school that I got accepted to, and I got my acceptance rescinded for it.
Brian was devastated. Everything he'd worked for his whole life, the reason he'd been pushing himself so hard for so many years, was just gone. After taking a year off, Brian ended up at a PhD program studying medicinal chemistry. And in a lot of ways, he says, this was probably a better path for him. He didn't have to go through the meat grinder that is medical school and residency. And his program, which was solidly good, if not top flight, allowed him to have a decent work-life balance that's continued into his postdoc at the NIH. A job that he says he finds interesting, challenging, and fulfilling. But even now, he still can't help feeling like a failure. In his Reddit post, he summarized it this way. I just feel that ever since I started prioritizing work-life balance, I've started to become less and less impressive in terms of accomplishments relative to my intelligence. I know that people of my intelligence are doing what I view to be much more impressive things than I am. It's the same story I saw again and again on Reddit. And Matt Sekreski told me it's a direct result of both the pressure we put on gifted kids and the way their brains work. Because not only have gifted kids been told their whole lives that they're destined for greatness, some studies suggest that their brains are wired for both emotional intensity and black and white thinking. The result? Perfectionism.
There's this idea that if you're not the best, you're a failure, right? And I think it's probably the pound for pound, the biggest source of burnout.
It's something Matt spends a lot of time on with his clients, convincing them that life isn't ranked on a 4-point scale. There is no best doctor or lawyer or artist or CEO. But he says that kind of thinking can be hard to unwind.
You know, kids come into my sobbing to my office, they get an 88 on a history test. And I'm like, as a grown-up, I'm like, oh, 88, that's not bad. You know, just move on with your life. You know, but it's catastrophic if you're 11, you know? And so perfectionism and achievement gets doubly reinforced, very hard to break. And, you know, I mean, it's the hamster wheel of doom, right? It's like you just faster and faster and faster and faster until it flings you off.
Matt says the most widely quoted figure about the number of gifted kids who end up burned out and unhappy is 1 out of 6, though he thinks it's a lot higher. But now, giftedness researchers like Matt are trying to change that, in part by taking a more holistic approach to gifted kids, especially in educational settings. Not thinking of them as just future engines of achievement, but as whole people, complete with the needs and deficits that all neurodivergent people have.
So the good news is that the best practices in gifted education are just the best practices in education.
Matt suggests 5 changes. First, level setting. Dividing kids into classes based not on their age, but on how advanced they are in a given subject. Second, curriculum compacting. Tailoring learning materials to cut out the content kids already know or have mastered and replacing it with related enrichment or activities.
Which A, moves us through the material faster, but also gives us more time to be playful, to build something, to get messy, and do the things kids are going to actually remember.
Third, bringing back classes like shop, art, music. Subjects that, again, allow kids to be creative, to explore their interests and talents. And finally, ditching traditional grading in favor of qualitative grading, so the kids can stop being fixated on grades and achievement and focus instead on the actual learning. Brian, for example, is struggling right now to unlearn the idea that he needs to be the best. It's something we talked about at the end of our conversation.
If you end up having kids and you have a gifted child, how do you hope for them to relate to their giftedness that is the same or that is different from how you relate to your giftedness?
First, I would impart the lesson that, like, yes, you still need to work, especially as you get older. It's not a sign of failure or weakness to actually put in effort. That's one. But the other is that you don't need to fulfill all of your potential, because trying to fulfill 100% of your potential, it could be very detrimental to your health. And in the end, your health is going to matter more than all of the accolades and accomplishments and whatever that you get throughout life. They're great, but only if you do so in a healthy way.
That story was reported by Liz Tong.